phony wars and rising stars, from the conflict in and out of Ukraine to the first in an episodic series of looks at what we might think of as the next political generation waiting in the wings in Russia. Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow shadows. This podcast, of varying length, frequency and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons like you, and also by the crisis exercise software company Conductor. So let's start by looking, needless to say, at the war, where we've had Bakhmut falling, probably mainly kinda, and the Russian region of Belgorod raided. Two engagements whose real significance probably is distinctly out of proportion with their apparent status. Let's be honest, look, the Russian military calendar has got 18 days of so-called days of military glory, recognising various victories from the 27th of January, which is the commemoration of the lifting of the siege of Leningrad in 1944, through to the 24th of December, which is on the victory over Turkey in the Siege of Izmail in 1790. That was one of Alexander Suvorov's great engagements. I really don't think that the fall of Bakhmut after so long is likely to deserve to be another commemorative day of military glory, though let's be perfectly honest, in the current environment with a Russia that is desperate for good news, doesn't necessarily mean that it won't. Nonetheless, I mean, this particular meat grinder, which has left the Wagner mercenary group on the one hand sort of triumphant, but on the other hand also deeply, deeply degraded in terms of its forces, and it's noteworthy that Wagner is now being withdrawn from Bakhmut and being replaced by regular troops, even though they might actually be regular in inverted commas, forces raised from the Donetsk-Luhansk People's Republic, which are probably rather less capable than most. But anyway, after that kind of meat grinder, I can't help feeling that although I think the initial intent from Ukraine was precisely to use it to that purpose, to allow the Russians, given the degree to which they were desperate for a victory, or at least to present Putin with a victory, and to allow the Russians to batter themselves time and time again against the Ukrainian defences, not just suffering huge numbers of casualties, but also in the process distracting them, taking away their capacity to launch any meaningful offensives anywhere else. Though, towards the end, as I say, I can't help feel that Kyiv itself also got sucked into this whole conflict. It is clearly the point that although the Ukrainians have demonstrated themselves to be much, much better at thinking their way through the course of this war, they are human too, and this is a conflict which can often attain the status of a real grudge match. Still, in the main, though, this is not really a defeat for Kyiv, in that they have lost a city which has already been really rendered into just simply a plain of rubble more than an actual city, any more than it's really a victory for Moscow. But of course, Prigozhin will claim it. And on that note, it's worth noting, you know, as we continue to look at the decline, fall, and so forth, rinse and repeat, until finally the cycle ends, of Prigozhin, some people were noting that some posters have cropped up around Belgorod, which, after all, as I'll talk about in a moment, has been raided by Russians in Ukrainian service, looking for all the world like election posters for Prigozhin, and very much sort of fating him in terms which cannot help but look like a direct challenge to Putin, along with the poster of the really deeply unphotogenic individual. It had the simple slogan, strength, conviction, stability. And that in and of itself is noteworthy. A stabilnost, stability, is so much part of Putin's usual offer. But then, even less subtly, a strong leader not a bunker coward. Now, again, although it could be claimed, oh, no, no, it's a reference to Sergei Shoigu, the defence minister, or whoever else, clearly this would be regarded as a dig at Putin. He's the, well, indeed, Navalny created that expression, you know, the old man in the bunker. Now, I have to say, I don't think that Prigozhin is campaigning. These posters, and there's not that many of them by all accounts, but nonetheless they very quickly got photographed and did the rounds on social media. But anyway, these posters for me are actually part of a black propaganda campaign against Prigozhin. Prigozhin himself may not be the deepest thinker, but he must know how stupid it is to be putting posters up like this, especially when he's currently not campaigning for anything. But on the other hand, if you really wanted to cause trouble for Prigozhin, or perhaps within the general Russian elite, this seems to be a pretty good idea. So I'm guessing that either this was done by Prigozhin's enemies inside Russia, or, less likely but also conceivable, by the Ukrainians to just further stir the pot. After all, it's worth noting the degree to which Kirill Budanov, the head of Ukrainian military intelligence, actually tends to talk up Prigozhin. And Wagner generally, saying that they are the best of the Russian troops and that he respects Prigozhin as an enemy and so forth. Now, it may well be that he genuinely believes that. But on the other hand, I can't help but think that, given how often Budanov seems to be making statements really as psychological warfare operations against the Russians, precisely to cause division, cause dismay, whatever, that actually it's a part of a whole campaign just simply to widen the existing rifts within the Russian leadership. Anyway, one way or the other, I was entertained by that, but not necessarily believing that it shows that Prigozhin is on the political path. So, the fall of Bakhmut. Militarily, okay, it maybe moves the lines on the map by some minuscule amount, but in practice, actually, the real importance of Bakhmut precisely is in a further way in which the Russians squandered any kind of offensive capability in the earlier stages of this year. The raid on Belgorod, by contrast, is, I think, an interesting operation that could well have an importance totally disproportionate to its actual scale. Because, after all, what do we see? We saw, it's hard to know for sure, 100, maybe 200 soldiers drawn from the Russian Volunteer Corps and the Freedom of Russia Legion, which are, it's worth dwelling briefly on them, units of Russian volunteers that are serving Ukraine's cause, ranging from out-and-out neo-Nazis, and particularly the Russian Volunteer Corps, does seem to be one that has disproportionately drawn people from the extreme right, whereas the Freedom of Russia Legion seems to be more centrist and more liberal. But anyway, the point is these are all opponents of the Putin regime for various reasons. And although they disagree quite extremely on quite what they would want to see in a new Russia, nonetheless, they are all committed to the downfall of the Putin regime, and they see Ukraine delivering a decisive defeat as being one of the best ways towards that. The point is, though, that these are units which are, well, essentially within Ukraine's Foreign Legion. But certainly, these are not autonomous elements. They are armed, trained, equipped, fed by the Ukrainians. Essentially, they are instruments of Ukrainian military intelligence, GUR or HUR. And there's no way that they could have carried out this operation autonomously. Just simply the fact that they clearly had fire support in some cases, and just simply were able to go across the border and then return, says something about that. And therefore, in some ways, we really should see this as part of GUR's wider campaign of bringing chaos to Russia, which I should mention that I talk about in today's Sunday Times, if anyone's interested. And I've circulated to my patrons a copy of that because it's behind a paywall. Now, this raid, on one level, it almost seems trivial. Crossed the border, which wasn't really defended, shot up a border guard post, killing some people there, went a few kilometres into Russia, took very briefly a few villages, again, shot up the police stations, killed a couple of conscripts who were involved in the sort of very sparse defences in the region, and then soon withdrew under a certain level of Russian fire. Now, look, of course, from the point of view of the raiders, they talk about this sort of great success, that they suffered no casualties, that they took a couple of Russian armoured personnel carriers as trophies. If you listen to the Russians, they suffered massive casualties, I think up to 70 dead, as well as losing a range of armoured vehicles, essentially American-supplied ones. And that's significant, we'll come to in a moment. Of course, the truth is probably somewhere in between. The fact of the matter is that, as I said, because this border isn't really protected, it's actually pretty simple a matter to cross it. They distributed some leaflets saying that they were fighting for the freedom of all Russians rather than against Russians, but it doesn't seem to have had that much traction there and there on the ground. And their withdrawal, frankly, doesn't sort of change the situation on the ground in any meaningful way. But if we think of this as part of the, as I say, I mean, I don't diminish it when I say the phony war, but the pre-proper Ukrainian counter-offensive phase, in which it is really could be considered a shaping operation. In other words, something that is there precisely to make the battlefield as conducive to the Ukrainians as possible. Well, it's actually quite significant. Not least because it certainly was too big for Moscow to try and cover up. And it's quite striking that we see now in the Russian media attempts to directly compare Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky with people like the Chechen terrorist and jihadist Shamil Basayev, who was the man behind the 1995 seizure of a hospital in Budyonovsk, and then in 2004 a school in Beslan. Both very high profile, very politically significant, but also quite sort of horrific terrorist operations, which, and indeed he himself was killed in 2006 as a result of what looks like a covert Russian military operation. Now, again, obviously we shouldn't take this talk of Zelensky as a terrorist that seriously, but it is quite striking that additional narrative firepower, as well as additional genuine outrage, I think was added by the fact that at the very same time you had the deputy head of GUR, Vadim Skibitsky, essentially saying that, yes, of course, GUR carries out assassinations of Russians in Russia, something that Zelensky himself had previously denied, and that Putin would be considered to be at the absolute top of their list because he's behind everything that's going on in Ukraine. And again, remember that Zelensky had previously said that they absolutely did not and were not targeting Putin. This is at the time of the drone attacks on the Kremlin. And instead, they were just waiting and in some ways leaving Putin for an eventual war crimes tribunal. Now, look, this could just simply be Zelensky saying what Zelensky needs to say at the moment. He is, after all, a political leader. It could be kind of good cop, bad cop routine between Zelensky and GUR, and particularly its chief, Kirill Budanov. Or it just could be that, in fact, policy shifts. But one way or the other, you know, obviously the Russians are whipping themselves up into a state of patriotic outrage, ignoring the minor detail of the drones and artillery rounds hitting hospitals and schools across Ukraine. But we'll leave that. But I think the particular reason is not just simply because of the fact that there was this raid, or indeed that it seems to be part of a wider campaign of sabotage that I've talked about in the past that is being waged probably by GUR across Russia. It is also that this particular raid, however small it may have been, imposes dilemmas on the Russians, which is always kind of the aim of these kind of operations. And in particular, it poses them with a very intractable challenge. Do they try and secure the long Russian border outside the immediate sort of combat areas? Because we have to realise that, you know, essentially combat has been focused in a particular part of the Russian-Ukrainian border, and really sort of only about half of it. So do they then decide that they're actually going to need to have troops all along the border, at least in a position whereby, you know, within a matter of hours or perhaps at most a day, they can reinforce any particular area? which will take up a lot of their current troops. Now, sure, they could send conscripts, more conscripts, and such like, but you know, nonetheless, this means distracting from their current focus on hunkering down, preparing to weather the Ukrainian counteroffensive. Because from the Ukrainians' point of view, every company, every regiment, every brigade, which actually is transferred from the defences of the occupied territories to protecting Russian borders, is a victory. So that's option one. And clearly, from a military point of view, that is deeply unsatisfactory, especially because unless you actually move a huge amount of troops, more than the Russians frankly can, you honestly cannot secure that whole border. And given that the Ukrainians, particularly thanks to their Western assistance, have intelligence superiority, in other words, they will know where the Russian forces are, they will also know where the weak points are. So in a way, you cannot prevent these kind of cross-border raids. So option two would be, well, essentially just accept it. To not bother with any kind of substantive reinforcement of the border. Maybe you kind of redistribute some police and National Guard assets to provide some kind of second order security or something like that. But basically, you accept that these kind of small raids, which after all can be launched without much in the way of sort of the logistical preparation that could tip you off that something's coming, well, that these kind of raids just simply, well, they may well happen in the future, and so be it. The problem is that, well, let's be honest, this makes perfect military sense on a very ruthless and some would say cynical level. It is politically dangerous. It implies that actually Moscow either cannot protect its own people or just, and this is probably more accurate, doesn't give a damn. And that plays to the whole prevailing and I would say increasingly debilitating where's Waldo, or in this case, where's Putin, situation in which, although Putin occasionally is wheeled out for set piece pronouncements and so forth, he just doesn't seem to be active, and particularly he's not fulfilling what is arguably the number one function of any national leader, which is the protection of the homeland and protection of the citizenry. So, you know, again, yes, this makes sense, and it may well be that the Kremlin will feel that it can just simply weather whatever particular local outrage emerges as a result, though of course in the modern social media interconnected political environment, some outrage from Belgorod can very quickly be communicated not just to Moscow but also to Vladivostok. You know, actually these things all have repercussions and reverberations all across the country. But nonetheless, I think this is the kind of dilemmas that this on paper very small and almost meaningless raid actually imposes on the situation. And I do think it contributes to this growing awareness in Moscow within the elite that this is not a conflict that is, well, not just not going well, but that Moscow cannot expect to win soon. And here's an interesting thing. For a long time, this has actually been Putin's very deliberate messaging. But a messaging in part to the Russian people, more or less saying this is why you have to accept privations, this is why you have to accept mobilizations and so forth. But at least as much, if not in some places much, much more so, towards the West. Essentially in that vein of, look, I can keep this up as long as you want. Your, whatever it is at the moment, is it approximately $3 billion of assistance that the West is providing in military and financial terms to Ukraine every month? You know, are you really willing to pay that, whatever? There was a certain bravado to the sense that this could become something of a forever war. Now what's interesting is that actually the same language, the same understandings about how long this war can continue are coming out with a different resonance, a different tone. Actually a sober awareness that Russia may well be mired in a quagmire, a dangerous and debilitating quagmire that could last for a long time. We saw this, for example, in a recent pronouncement by none other than Prigozhin himself, who essentially was suggesting that actually Russia needs to North Koreanize itself properly and turn every single effort towards the war if it really wants to win it. And as Anna Arutunyan, in a good piece for the Spectator Coffee House blog, I'll leave a link in the program notes, suggests this is not actually Prigozhin seriously advocating these kind of methods, but in a sense, I wouldn't quite say tongue-in-cheek, but certainly with an aim to scare rather than encourage, is warning that those are the kinds of methods that would be needed to win this war. And even out of the mouths of drunks, if not babes, we had Dmitry Medvedev, whom these days we really only hear about when he's producing another ramblingly incoherent diatribe against the West that he affects to hate so much. But nonetheless, this time he actually said something that probably expresses the beliefs or fears of many within the elite. He said, "This conflict will be very long. It will last for decades, probably. This is a new reality, the new way of living." And then he went on to suggest, "There'll be 3 years of truce, 2 years of conflict, and everything will start all over again." This may well be the way that, from the Russians' point of view, they can think of the best-case scenario. If you can't break Ukraine, if you can't break the alliance of people, countries supporting Ukraine, at least not before those countries have managed to stand up defence industries and the like, which will allow Ukraine to be able to weather a certain diminution in foreign assistance, well, then maybe a frozen conflict that at times defrosts in violent pyrotechnic ways could perhaps be the best you can possibly hope for. And that means you don't lose. And there's a certain way that, you know, from the Russians' point of view, given that NATO, as far as they're concerned, is arrayed against them and Ukraine is just the battlefield for this conflict, well, there is a certain degree in which they might think that to not lose is a victory of sorts. But it's a very, very pale and indigestible, if I can mix my metaphors, victory. And certainly one that in the longer term is actually going to be very, very dangerous for Russia, given the debilitating costs in terms of the economy, in terms of demographics, in terms of military capability, in terms of legitimacy, and in terms of international credibility. So from all those points of view, actually, what Medvedev is warning of is not a good scenario for Russia. It's not a good scenario for Ukraine either. It's not a good scenario for the West. It's not a good scenario for anyone, with the possible exception of China. But nonetheless, what was once seen as a useful threat against the West is now also becoming something of a nightmare in Russia. And particularly a nightmare for those Russians who, to be honest, do not have such an emotional commitment to the war. I mean, again, I think this is something that we really need to accept, the degree to which for people like Putin, Patrushev, and those of his ilk, his mindset, his generation, this is an absolutely necessary politically existential struggle for Russia. It is also the expression of anger, resentment, a sense of betrayal, that they feel that the West has turned against Russia unfairly, is trying to deny Russia its proper place in the world, and therefore needs to be punished. There is a really strong emotional dimension to this, a sense at once of outraged victimhood and spiteful revenge. And that emotional dimension, as I say, is on the whole, in my opinion, absent from many, if not most, of the slightly younger, the next political generation of Russian leaders. They may well not be fans of the West. They may see good geopolitical reasons why the West's interests are not Russia's. But I don't think there's quite this emotional dimension. And that's why, after the break, what I'm going to do is start a series of occasional profiles of figures from that next political generation. Not because I'm saying this is the guy who's going to be the next president or anything like that, but rather to say these are the kinds of guys from which, in due course, a new Russian president will emerge. And I'll be starting with Marat Husnulin, currently the Deputy Prime Minister for Construction and Regional Development. And if you don't think that someone from construction really is likely to become the next president, well, remember, this was also originally the background of Sergei Shoigu, who may now be the Defence Minister, but at some point was considered quite a strong front runner to be Putin's successor. Let's be honest, after what Putin's doing to his Russia, maybe it'll need a builder afterwards. Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counter-terrorism, civil affairs and the like. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galliotti, or on Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode. So, I was at an event in Berlin, and someone asked me to give an example of the kind of rising younger generation who not only have demonstrable political capacities still to rise, but also who seem to be out of step, particularly with the kind of the whole Putinism, Patrushevism, ultranationalism of the moment. And the first name that I came up with was indeed Marat Husnulin. Now look, I would stress that this is an occasional series of people who will be looking at the next political generation down, the people who don't tend to get the same amount of political coverage in the West, is not intended to be a list of the next potential Russian presidents. I must admit, I do despair sometimes at those kind of cheap articles that want to throw together just a handful of names, when at present the exercise is entirely meaningless. So much will depend on not just when Putin goes, but how he goes. Is he toppled? Does he get to choose a successor? All of these kind of things. As I said, they're more just the kind of list of people that we might want to be watching. And also through them, a way of understanding the dynamics of what's happening within the upper elite, outside the charmed circle of people at the very top. Anyway, on with Marat Shakirzyanovich, and you can imagine that I stumbled a little bit on that, Husnulin, who is a Russian Tatar politician, which again is interesting and worth noting, who is currently the Deputy Prime Minister for Construction and Regional Development and has been since 2020, having previously served as the Deputy Mayor of Moscow from 2010 to 2020. Now, he is a stripling at the age of 56. He was born in 1966 in Kazan, the capital of Tatarstan. He read economics at Kazan State Finance and Economics Institute, and then went on to take a master's in management and later on a candidate of sciences in economics. Though, as is so often the way with high-flying Russian politicians who get higher degrees, there may be some suggestions that his thesis for the candidate of sciences thing might have been written by someone else, might have been plagiarized. I'm sure that's totally untrue. But nonetheless, the questions have been made. In some ways, what happens is becoming a candidate of sciences has become something of a status symbol, a little bit like getting your own Mercedes G-Wagon. From 2001 until 2010, Husnulin was the Minister of Construction, Architecture, Housing and Utilities, that's a title and a half, for the Republican Tatarstan. And this was a time when there was a lot of federal investments going into Tatarstan, as well as actually money being spent from this relatively prosperous oil-producing region, after all. And it was going into, for example, building large housing projects around Kazan and various other Tatar cities, Nizhnekamsk, Ilyabuga, and so forth. And this seems to be where Husnulin, I think, really came to appreciate the value of the mega project, in both crude economic but also political terms. And it's worth noting that he was also very much involved with the beginning of the construction of the huge range, I think there were 26 different sports facilities that were involved in the 2013 Summer Universiade, sort of student Olympics. And I remember when I went to Tatarstan a few years later, apart from being, for some strange reason, regularly stopped by police for document checks, or in one case, to open up my coat, presumably to show that I wasn't a suicide bomber. Anyway, but at the same time, it was really striking how, and I think this was 2015, I believe, maybe 2016, but the degree to which the Universiade was still being hyped as a great moment of Tatarstan's glory. So Husnulin was very much involved in setting that up. And I think this is the important thing about mega projects, and certainly mega projects as approached by Husnulin. First of all, they give you disproportionate amounts of prestige and profile. You know, building, for example, you know, a whole new mini town in the suburbs of a major city with all the utilities and such like gets you a lot more attention than just simply rebuilding housing across the city randomly. Likewise, you know, high-profile projects like the Universiade become national priorities rather than just local priorities, and in that respect bring you to the attention of the big boys at the centre. And when I say big boys, I'm talking in both political as well as economic terms. So, you know, I think, you know, he realised that actually these kind of projects are much, much more important politically to the individual who's piloting them than just the kind of the day-to-day stuff. Secondly, these are kind of projects which actually, let's be honest, Russia can do and can often do rather well. I mean, even if we think of the Sochi Winter Olympics, with which it's worth noting he was not involved with particularly. But there, I mean, yes, there was a lot of ribald and frankly slightly unfair press commentary from the West in advance about the sort of weird toilets with no doors and other things. But at the end of the day, if I may use that overused sporting cliche, it was ready. And generally speaking, the Sochi Winter Olympics were considered something of a Russian triumph. It may well be that precisely they end up cutting corners. It may well be that 5 years later, the facilities will start to collapse, and they are. It may well be that they have to use, well, let's just say, construction labour that veers close, dangerously close to the traffic labourers. And it may well be that there will be a lot of corruption and embezzlement in the process. But ultimately, they tend to actually successfully do the job. So that's the other thing. It is something that is achievable. I think that's really important because delivery, a term that has become something of a sort of cliched buzzword amongst politicians and political analysts in the West, also matters in Russia. To be regarded as someone who can actually get things done is really important. And finally, and shall I say, on a little bit less of an elevated level, you know, there are huge financial opportunities for the individual concerned, not just to make themselves rich, but also to make their clients and their friends rich. And precisely because of the opportunities, it will probably mean that other interest groups, from real estate speculators through to construction companies, have a reason to come to you. And whether or not you actually just simply use that as an opportunity to get corruption payoffs, or whether you instead barter that for future political advantage, is up to you. But the point is, that's there. So Husnuddin, even while he was in Tatarstan, acquires something of a reputation as a person who gets things done, but also can look after his friends. The former in particular helps ensure that he comes to Moscow. So in 2010 to 2020, as I mentioned, Marat is deputy mayor and again is in charge of major construction. And under Sobyanin, mayor of Moscow, clearly there is a hell of a lot of that. What does he do? I mean, he revives the Moscow City Financial and Business Center, which essentially, ever since the 2008 financial meltdown, had been pretty much logjammed. He's involved in the massive expansion of not just the metro, but also the Moscow Circle light rail line. And certainly it was very striking that at a time when in the West the issue is how many years does it create to establish a new metro station, in Russia the question was as often as not how many metro stations are going to be built per year. What else? Well, there was a huge expansion of Moscow itself in 2011. Boundaries of the cities were redrawn to bring in the so-called New Moscow for a 40% increase in the population. Now, look, on one level, one could say, well, yeah, but that's just simply a boundary drawing. But nonetheless, what that did mean was all of a sudden a whole variety of other projects were inherited, grandfathered across into Husnuddin's remit. He was involved in the beautification of the city, which is, again, very much a feature of the Sobyanin era. And again, often on the basis not just of, you know, there was a lot of small scale, but nonetheless, you know, frequently imaginative and successful projects about, you know, basically turning this street into a pedestrianised one and fixing that particular local park. But there was also scope for mega projects like Park Zaryadye, on the site of the former Rossiya Hotel, gone but never forgotten
but certainly from my point of view, not really mourned either. But, you know, huge project right in the centre, the sort of thing which does not only involve a lot of money changing hands, but which is also clearly becomes a high-profile event. And then, finally, sports once again. He was involved in the huge reconstruction of the Luzhniki Stadium for the 2017 FIFA Confederations Cup and the 2018 FIFA World Cup. So, you know, for all these reasons, you know, this definitely got Husnullin a lot of notice. And so it's perhaps unsurprising that in January 2020 he was made Deputy Prime Minister of Russia for Construction and Regional Development as part of Mishustin's general attempt to create a, essentially a cabinet of people who can actually get things done. Now, the irony is that since then, at a time when war has created so many headaches for people across the spectrum of different government functions, it's created huge opportunities for Husnullin to shine. He's been involved, for example, at an early point in responses to dealing with the issue of the Crimean water supply. Then he's a key point man with issues like the reconstruction of cities, first Mariupol, I mean, obviously reconstructed because the Russians had flattened it, and most recently Bakhmut. And again, all of these give him disproportionate amounts of public profile. They also give him the crucial asset of presidential contact. Putin himself wants to position himself as being the person involved in overseeing the reconstruction of cities like Mariupol, which he famously visited. And that means that he also is seen in the company of Husnullin. And to a degree, he is now dependent upon Husnullin's capacity to deliver. Now, that's obviously a risk for Husnullin. Should I call him Marat? No, Husnullin, I don't know him well enough. Anyway, that creates a risk. If he's seen to have failed, he could be, you know, thrown under the bus. But nonetheless, if he is able to make at least some kind of success, and remember, this is a man who has demonstrated he can deliver, then actually what he's doing is allowing Putin to make good on his promises, and that is always a very good thing to be seen to be done. Putin is looking for people who can make him look good and basically take over the tedious, actual, necessary duties of doing that. After all, this is a role that Husnullin had demonstrated he was quite good at even before in his time back in Tatarstan, where actually he was behind a lot of the projects that Tatar leader Rustam Minnikhanov would later claim the credit for. And I'm thinking particularly of projects like the Alabuga Special Economic Zone, which was certainly presented as having been a great success, and Minnikhanov always liked to emphasise his own role in creating it back in 2005-06. But in practice, it was Husnullin who put in all the hard graft. And subsequently, Husnullin, once he was in Moscow, who also managed to persuade Sabyanin to make a particular trip there and to use it as a basis for developing horizontal ties between Moscow City and Tatarstan, which again, Husnullin didn't make a big deal of, and obviously Minnikhanov claimed all the credit for, but the point is, it was his job. There is often a real virtue in being the very competent subordinate who makes the principal look good. And if we're honest about it, in many ways this was actually precisely the reason for Putin's own rise, even if often in his case the sort of the competent actions he was doing involved corruption and escaping the country ahead of arrest warrants. And finally, this gives him, Husnullin, an opportunity to be, as it were, involved in the war effort without actually being a warrior. He's a rebuilder instead. It's quite striking that this is actually how Sobyanin himself has tried to position himself. You know, although Sobyanin has occasionally had to pay homage to the whole Zed cult and was also necessarily involved in establishing volunteer battalions from Moscow in the earlier stages of the war, something that he didn't seem to particularly relish. But the point is, instead, actually Moscow has been able to step in and say that it will be involved in reconstruction projects. And that allows Sobyanin to show that he is loyal to the country without actually getting his hands too deeply steeped in blood. Well, in some ways, Husnullin is proving to be Sobyanin on steroids. Now, of course, look, he has done well for himself and his family. I don't know of any Russian official who really lives on his salary alone. Of course not. And in some ways, that's actually also an asset for him. You know, if he were actually some kind of lily white incorruptible, then actually he would be regarded with suspicion by the rest of the elite, because in some ways he would be dangerous to them, as well as they'd probably think of him as some kind of a freak, wondering what was really going on there. So he is, you know, like figures like Shoigu, corrupt enough to be reassuring to the rest of the elite, but not so egregiously so that he seems to be kind of breaking the rules and being unduly guilty. Guilty? Oops, I meant greedy. Let's be perfectly honest, very few within the Russian elite seems to have much of a capacity to show guilt, certainly these days. So, this is Khusnulin. He's an example, definitely, of that next political generation. He's 56, so he's still got years in him, and that also means that he has a slightly different perspective. He's actually thinking about Russia not just 5 years out, but 10, 15 years out, maybe even 20 years out. He's very close to Sobyanin, which is a massively powerful political asset. Let's be honest, Sobyanin's status really makes him analogous to a deputy prime minister himself. Though it's interesting. I mean, at the moment he's still seen as Sobyanin's man. One can wonder if, before too long, Sobyanin might be seen as Khusnulin's man. It all depends. Khusnulin has demonstrated that he can work with Putin perfectly sort of comfortably. But on the other hand, he's keeping his hands clean as someone, you know, as clean as anyone in the cabinet can, but as someone who is a technocratic fixer, really, rather than an ideologue. It's almost as if actually a younger Shoigu had not become Minister of Defence and therefore been forced to follow that particular bloody path. And his language is interesting in that, again, he cleaves to the official line closely enough, but without the kind of extreme, toxic, Ukraine or West-hating rhetoric that we see on the parts of others. He is confident enough in his position not to feel that he has to go too far in that direction. And all of this is, I think, manifest in his increasing profile. I mean, in April, he had visited Bakhmut even before it had fallen, and he wrote on social media, where is it? The city is damaged, but it can be restored. We've done it before. As soon as the operational situation allows, we'll start going in there and working on it one step at a time. All good, rousing rhetoric. And the interesting thing is he has, in fact, been given the title of Special Presidential Envoy on top of his Deputy Prime Ministership role after, you know, apparent successes in beginning to restore the infrastructure of the occupied territories in Ukraine, and indeed accompanying Putin on his visit to Mariupol. So again, it's very much this sort of talking about the war, but not about the war, you know, as soon as the operational situation allows. I mean, that is as circumspect language as one could imagine, to basically say as soon as the shooting stops in the city. But instead focusing on what can be restored, and again, we've done it before. Then, interestingly, in May, he was actually involved in a meeting of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation within the Russia Islamic World Forum in his home city of Kazan. So, you know, a big gathering of representatives from Islamic states around the world, which, again, is interesting because that's outside his standard remit as Deputy Prime Minister. And although Khusnulin is not in any way a religious figure, nonetheless, since he comes from Tatarstan, he's also been given something of a role of liaising with the Islamic world. You know, they have Ramzan Kadyrov for the more lunatic end of things, Khusnulin for the grey-suited businessman level. Anyway, his key theme was precisely that the Islamic world is opposed to Western sanctions on Russia, which is kind of true to some degree, but only to some degree. But nonetheless, this is it. You know, he's demonstrating that now he's involved on a slightly higher, wider level. That he's also involved in foreign affairs. That is not just simply about who can we buy new cement from. And he very much emphasised about the sort of the importance of the community of nations between Russia and the Muslim world. And in some ways, this also kind of connects directly to his formal remit, because he's also the point man on the new North-South International Transport Corridor. Boring title. Anyway, but nonetheless, it's a 7,200-kilometre-long transport artery, which is meant to stretch all the way from St. Petersburg in the north of Russia to ports in Iran and India. And according to Husnulin, at the moment, sort of cargo capacity along these routes is a little over 20 million tonnes a year. But thanks to this expansion, it could reach 30 million by 2025 and 35 million by 2030. So the idea is, again, it's about a reorientation of Russia for the long term, away from its dependence on Europe and, not so explicitly mentioned, China, but instead trying to build what capacity it can, what connections it can in the south, which I think really does matter. You know, it's again, the Muslim world, but also India. And as if that wasn't enough, this whole project will, in classic Husnulin style, provide opportunity for all kinds of, well, yes, of course, enrichment. But more broadly, actually allowing him to develop networks of clients because they will have the opportunity to enrich themselves. I mean, this project, for example, is going to mean overhaul of the R217 Kavkaz Highway that goes through the sort of the North Caucasus region, as well as ports in the Caspian Basin, we're talking about Astrakhan region, Dagestan. And all of this is going to mean local connections, local patronage, local networks being built. And this is at a time when most Moscow politicians are just that. They are Moscow politicians. For them, they will happily holiday and have their dachas on the outskirts, but essentially their professional world ends at the UMKAD Moscow Ring Road. Not Husnulin. So this is why I think that he's a particularly interesting example of the next generation worth tracking. He has demonstrated a certain degree of competence, not just politically, but also in terms of accomplishing things. That he's very much associated with construction and reconstruction, and as a result, quality of life issues, which may well, as I say, I think be incredibly important in a post-Putin era, given the savaging that is likely to continue to happen to ordinary Russians' quality of lives. He's managed to quite adroitly connect himself with the war, but not as a warrior. But in some ways, I don't want to call him as a healer. That's, I think, making it sound a little bit too hippie. But nonetheless, in a much more positive role. He has managed to combine enriching himself with building networks of people who also, essentially through connections to him, can do well. But not necessarily in a crude sense as being just, you know, people who are his wallets and such like. But just basically people who see him as a handy friend to have, and who will therefore make money as a result of that. And he's demonstrating an awareness that even when you're based in Moscow, nonetheless, it's important to actually look to developing local connections around the rest of the country. Now, one can seriously wonder whether or not Russia will be ready for a Tata president. Ironically, again, going back to the Shoigu example, in some ways, the fact that Shoigu came from Tiva in the far Siberia probably was less of an issue, both because Shoigu was able to fit in with Russian Orthodoxy very easily, but also precisely because the Tivans are not a large and powerful force within Russia. The Tatars, they are more noteworthy, more powerful, and at various times they have been a serious threat to Muscovy and then Russia. And so for those reasons, I'm not entirely convinced that Husnulin would find it easy to be a Russian president, but not necessarily impossible. And also, especially in a post-Putin era, it's not likely to be just about the president. There are going to be spaces for other powerful figures within the system. And who knows, maybe Husnulin will be one of them. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/InMoscowShadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well. Mm-hmm.
Silence and history, that's all you're gonna get. Gonna get all the best bits. It's called censorship. When I make an announcement, my coming from a dick. Say they are the Jedi strain. Say they are before. I'm telling you what's reality. I'm telling you right to fall. You've gotta have this and you've gotta have that. If you haven't, you're fucking poor. When I play TV program, the least you want it more. You're a dead big body. That's a living dick. Saying every street, that's all you're gonna get. Gonna get all the big bits. It's called censorship. When I make an announcement, my feet full of shit.
I always wanted to experience war. I was raised on it. Every birthday I got cap guns and helmets and canteens. Played war all the time when I was a kid. Television was always the best thing for you. Make a man out of you.